Dr. Dion George, Minister of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment.
The responsibility of this department is massive. I'm able to do my job without fear, favor, or prejudice. For example, there was the lion issue, there was the penguin issue, there were the emissions issue, there was the fisheries issue. All these things that were actually left behind that proper decisions were not made on. And the balancing act that needs to be found, it's very difficult. But I look, I think, oh, you know what? I had my hand in that. So when we went to see the penguins, I looked at them and I thought, I'm so pleased I could give you a little bit more food. It just fills me with joy.
In terms of corruption, that's like the big thing for South Africans. Was there corruption in the department? Have we fired anybody? South Africans want accountability. So how's it, guys? And welcome to the DA's podcast. We are joined by the Minister of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment. Quite a long title. Mm-hmm. Dr. Dion George, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ryan Smith.
I'm Kabelo Khobisa.
Thamsanqa Mapena.
And we've got the minister with us today. So we're very, very glad to have you, Dr. Dion George. And there's so much to be discussed. But I think just to start off, it's been a year. It's been just over a year of the GNU. You're the first national minister of this portfolio from the Democratic Alliance. Just let us in a little bit. Just tell us how it's been. How has government changed you? What's it been like?
Well, I must say it's been fascinating so far. I mean, obviously, it was a surprise that we ended up in government because, you know, who knew what the electorate was going to do? But here we are. So it was a surprise result. A surprise government, and of course, a surprise minister. I mean, you know, I was in finance. I was in opposition for almost 18 years. Cool. So that's a very, very long time. And of course, I've never been in government. I've never been in local government or provincial government or national. And now here I am, the minister. So it really was quite a... Firstly, it was a big surprise. And then it was quite a shock when I arrived and I realized that's... This is a massive, massive department. In fact, it is the biggest scope in government, according to the Minister of Public Administration. Sheesh. So it is extremely big, very varied. And also, my background in finance obviously gives me a certain skill set. But I'm learning so much all the time. So the last year has shot past, I can tell you. It feels like, you know, it just I've just started. But I think what is amazing is that I think the department... As much as I do think former Minister Creasy did attempt to do the best she could in that department, I do think so. But I think she was constrained by a number of things that got in her way. I'm very fortunate because I actually am from the DA and I'm not from the former ruling party. So we understand the separation of party and state. So the DA doesn't try to interfere with me because we wouldn't do that. That's the one thing. And the other thing is that because I don't know all the players in the industry and came almost like fresh into it, I'm able to do my job without fear, favor, or prejudice. And that is actually something. So a lot of people around me are remarking on that because I obviously make decisions, you know. Many people don't know how to make decisions or don't want to or feel constrained. But I do make the decisions that need to be made. For example, there was the lion issue, there was the penguin issue, there were the emissions issue, there was the fisheries issue. All these things that were actually left behind that proper decisions were not made on, that I then picked up. And they are very controversial because obviously, and people should feel very strongly about the environment. So, and the balancing act that needs to be found, it's very difficult. So what for me is quite exciting is because obviously I'm getting older. So I think my life's experience has been very useful. I mean, I have studied quite a lot and I've had other jobs as well in finance, etc. And then, of course, I was the shadow minister for finance for a while. So I'm finding that everything that I've learned in my life, I'm actually being able to apply here. So if you look at it, for example, on the... Maslow's hierarchy of needs, for example. They have a thing called self-actualization. And I actually feel that I'm becoming everything I can possibly become because I really feel every day stretched. You know, it's not easy. And I feel like, oh my goodness, this is really a hard job. But I think that's amazing because many people don't get that opportunity. So I'm very grateful for being in the ministry at this time. And also, I mean, we are pioneers. I mean, we always knew this was going to be scratchy and messy. And I mean, who knew what was going to happen and how long would this government last? Many people said, oh, well, you know, you'll be the minister for a week or two or a month or so. And here's a year already. So we didn't know. And so walking in the front, not knowing, it's on the one hand, it's very exciting because you can do things a different way. So I say to people often, look, I wasn't in government before, so I don't know how it worked. But that's a good thing because it didn't work. And now I'm doing it my way. So I am getting things done. And I think also the culture in the department is starting to change because you do lead from the front. It has to be that way. So I think people see, well, you know what? He's actually going to collect information. He's going to make a decision. And then he's going to do something. And I think that's the thing, because what's happened is I think government got stuck. There were so many different things that were trying to keep everybody happy so nothing ever happened. I don't feel that way. I think, well, you know, there's a thing that needs to be done. Collect information, make a decision, and then off you go.
Yeah, that's amazing, Dion. I just wonder, so you're having this almost self-actualizing experience, but I'm assuming it comes with a cost, right? We've spoken to a couple of your other colleagues in cabinet, and just the toll on family, I wonder if it has a toll on your health, because it seems very go, go, go. How are you finding the cost of it, and how are you managing that? How do you unwind?
It's extremely stressful, I can tell you. I mean, it really, really is. This is by far the most difficult job I've ever had to do. So, yes, that is so. And also, given that we don't have experience, I don't have experience, and I couldn't really turn to anybody in the party, for example, and say, well, okay, well, what did you learn? Because, you know, we couldn't. I did get some good advice from Barbara Creasy, so that was very useful, I thought. But I'm very fortunate because I do have a strong support structure. Also, as I mentioned, I'm getting older. You know, I'm 59. I just turned 59. So it's a great age to be at, frankly, because I think you let go of a lot of stuff and then, you know, then you think like, okay, well, in the time I have left, maximize it. So also, fortunately, I have a very supportive husband. He fully understands, is very excited about this adventure. But what was interesting, and I'm sure you wouldn't mind me mentioning it, is that, you know, every now and then the government has this wobble and you think, okay, well, uh-oh, it's going to end now.
Yeah.
So the one day we were just having a joke around and I said, well, okay, well, you know, I took the mic as if I was doing this show or something. And I said, well, Minister, how was it? I said, well, it was great. It was about a year and it was all very exciting. I learned all the stuff. And then I turned to Craig and I put the mic and I said, and Mr. Minister, how was it for you? And he said, it was very lonely. Wow. And I thought, that is in fact so, because I do, and much you see it in the newspaper, I travel a lot because my portfolio is international. I mean, there is no other way. Also, we have to go to Pretoria and there's other places in the country because you've got to go see for yourself. That's the best way. I mean, I went on a ranger course for 2 weeks to go and see what's going on. I went for a green scorpion course. Now I'm going for a fisheries officer course. So it does take its toll. But fortunately, I do not have children. And also, as I say, I've got a very supportive structure around me. So I've also said, you know, it's Craig, well, you know, you've got an open invitation. If I go somewhere in the country, whatever the case is, you can always come with me. But of course, he's also got things to do. So that is a thing. Also, I did not move from my home, which I think was a great move. Because when I became the minister, there was this, oh, well, you know, you have to move into state accommodation for various reasons. And I said, well, actually, no, I don't intend to move. I live in Cape Town. I won't go into detail where, but anyway, I live in Cape Town. And I said, no, I don't want to move because I'm very happy in my home. I've done renovations the way we like it, etc., and it's home. And also I discussed it with Craig, and he said, well, you know, he doesn't want to move because we're settled, and, you know, if I'm going to travel a lot, it's going to be in a strange place. I mean, why? And also, if I can pay for it myself and the people of the Republic don't have to, then why should I make them pay? So I didn't move. And I think so. I have my home comfort of I'm still in my home. And then, of course, we know this government, you know, it's obviously it's getting stronger and so on. But, I mean, who knows? If a day comes that, well, okay, the government's over. Well, nothing actually changes. The only thing I have to do is move my books and things that I've got in my office at Parliament in the Executive Building back to Mark's Building. And that's it. But I don't have to move or anything. So I think that was a good move. So my environment stayed quite normal as it was before. Obviously, just different. I've got protectors now, and you know they are meant to be with me, and so on. But I still run along the promenade where I am, and you know, so normality. And I think that's very important for me. And also, I think, given that, you know, I've got a particular program that I'm rolling out, etc. I'm quite focused. Mm. So, but yes, it can be very lonely because people have no idea. I say this to people, you really don't understand how hard it is, you know?
But that's very interesting that you say that, Dion. Well, look, I'm from Johannesburg, unfortunately.
I lived there for 30 years.
Yeah, so that's where I'm going because I think my interaction with you, I sort of knew you. You were once a councillor in the city of Johannesburg. And at some point, we were a constituency head for Midrand. I remember your CC was Pindo. I was a staff member for the DA then for another constituency in Johannesburg. But how did you get into politics? How did Dion George end up being a public representative of the DA as a councillor in the city of Johannesburg then and up to where we are now?
Well, I must say, I've always seen myself as an accidental politician because, I mean, I am an activist, you know, so, you know, some people would say he's a busybody. But anyway, I lived in Sandton Central. This was like before 2006, before the local elections. So anyway, I worked at a financial industry company. And so the one day I arrive at home and I see the sign. There's a property next door and there was a sign up. And it said, this development's going to be built. And then I saw there was like a tractor in there. They were busy doing stuff. So, of course, I thought, well, I mean, you know, it's a body corporate, Sandton Central. I don't know anything about this. And there's this environmental stuff you need to do. And there's processes because I know this because I was the chairman of the Residents Association. Oh. Yeah. So anyway, so I go next door and I say, well, you know, what are you doing? And they said, well, you know, we're building a building. I said, but you, what about the rules? You can't just do this. So anyway, there was a sign and then there was a number on the sign. So I phoned this person. I actually happened to get hold of the developer, who shall remain nameless. And then I said, look, you know, my name is Dion George. I'm the chairman of the body corporate next door. And I see you want to do something, but this is irregular. And that's when my political career actually started because his response to me was, I'll do what I want to.
Yeah.
And I thought, ooh, it's going to be interesting. So I happen to know Mike Moriarty from the DA, because years ago I lived in Parktown and Mike was the ward councillor. So he then recruited me to the DA in 1995.
Wow.
And he was my ward councillor. But I never really got too involved in the party, but I did help out every now and then. And I was a member, but I wasn't very active. I was building my career. So anyway, I phoned Mike and I said, well, Mike, you know, there's this developer next door and it's all troubling. Who's the ward councillor? So he says to me, it's Gilda Hurwitz. So I said, okay. So he gives me the number. I phone the number. I say, hello, Gilda. This is Dion George. There's this problem with this development. She says, well, you know, I'm on my way to have my hair done, but I will come back now. I'm going to turn around. And she did. She came back. She arrived. And then I said to her, look, she said, oh, this does look rather irregular. She's seen something through the council, but this is a problem. Anyway, fast forward, long story short, we then proceed to fight with this developer. Of course, they need to do the environmental impact assessment. We find that there's a wetland here. We find all sorts of things they've not done, etc. So this fight ensued. Eventually, to cut a very long story short, the developer was bankrupted, but somebody else took over. The building got built, but it looks very different to what it would have been. Mm-hmm. So that was the lasting impression there. So now surrounded by a lot of other bigger buildings, but that's a different story. But then Gilda said to me, look, you know, the election is coming up. Would you like to, you know, participate, be the campaign manager? You know, everybody looks for campaign managers. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I'm very busy. So she said to me, well, you know, it's not hard. Just give it a bash. So I said, okay, fine. So I then became the chairman of the Sandown branch. Then later on, she said, like, well, you know, don't you want to be a counselor? And I said, well, not really, because I got a job and I'm enjoying it. And she said, no, it's not a lot of work. There's a thing called.
They always say that.
Absolutely. And she lied. She said, no, it's not a lot of work. She said, and besides, there's this thing called ward counselor and a PR counselor. And she said, you know, you could be like a PR counselor. So I thought, and to be honest, I mean, although I'm pretty aware, I didn't really know the detail. So I thought, okay, let's have a look. So anyway, lo and behold, I then did apply to be a counselor. Oh. And I got elected in 2006 in the Joburg.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Local election. And then I went to council. And the job they gave me was to work on billing. You know, there's a massive big billing problem. Yeah. And so anyway, I went there and I realized that because the rates had changed and it was very complicated, the people in the office there that were trying to do the calculations were battling to understand how to hang it all together because it is complicated. I mean, you know, really not easy. So anyway, I dealt with a lot of queries and I assisted them with the actual spreadsheet of the thing. Like, you know, if you just put the numbers like this, this is how you calculate it, and so on. So it went very, very well. And then, you know, obviously I did my thing as counselor. And then Douglas Gibson was made ambassador to Thailand. And there was a vacancy. And then it was Dennis Hunt from Johannesburg. He was in my constituency subsequently. And he said, well, you know, do you want to go to Parliament? And I said, well, actually, I do enjoy my job. And, you know, it wasn't really on my radar. And he said, well, you know, there's few people there and we need somebody with finance and stuff. So maybe give it a bash. So I thought, okay, why not? Adventure. And so I was number one on the list to replace Douglas. And then I went to Parliament. And then I was.
And what year was that?
2008, in January 2008. It was unusual because there was a sitting because there was a law that they hadn't finished and they needed to be done. I can't remember the details. So it was unusual for Parliament to sit. I think it was the 15th of January. And they actually, I walked onto the floor with Sandy Callion and Willem Doerman.
Yeah.
So I was actually sworn in on the floor. And so in the Hansard, the very opening, the very first meeting in 2008 actually opens up with the presiding officer indicating that there's a vacancy and it's filled by Dr. D.T. George. And here he is. And there I was. So that's where the adventure began. So, I've always seen myself as like an accidental politician.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you were an accidental councillor, then an accidental MP, and now an accidental minister.
Well, a surprise minister. You know why a surprise minister? Because, I mean, you know, I'm really an inside person, you know. I mean, you get people. I mean, look, to be honest, in terms of the great outdoors, it is great. It's amazing. Yeah. And I'm learning all these amazing things that we have. But it's never been my thing. I've always been like an inside person because I lived in New York for 4 years and I've always lived in a big city. And of course, I used to go to Kruger like once a year, but I wouldn't call myself an environmentalist or a green person as such, you know. And then so here I was, the surprise minister, and now I'm learning all these things and I'm thinking, gee, there's a whole world, never mind outside the door, but also in the ocean.
I think it's also, it's difficult because people always say, what sort of attributes do you need to be a good politician or how do you become a politician? And I think your story kind of just cements many of our beginnings in politics is that we all started out essentially as active citizens. Mm. Something was going wrong or there was some sort of sense of injustice that we knew should not go ahead and we kind of took the baton and started running with it. I think that's how many of us in various different capacities and different fields and industries have ended up here. But let's now delve into your department, which is vast. I mean, it's massive. And I think the one thing, especially in the Western Cape province, that is on the tip of everyone's lips is what's happening with the fisheries. Because small-scale fishing is it's not just, I mean, you've got the commercial fishing with, you know, I&J and the big companies, but small scale fishing is a generational cultural actual heritage of the Western Cape. It's not just, you know, you get a fishing rights allocation or a quota. It's people paying for their kids to go to school. It's putting food on tables. It's livelihoods.
Yeah.
What have you managed to leverage on that particular issue? Because I think it's the Western Cape predominantly that's affected by that sort of issue in particular.
The fisheries department or the fisheries branch is extremely complicated. I mean, really, it is extremely complicated. It's because, remember, what you're doing is you're having a look because we count the fish, so we know more or less what the stock is. So what you're doing is you're saying this is what the stock is available, and then this is the cap, the total catch, for example, that can be taken, and then it gets allocated on various rights holders because you don't want to overfish. Mm. So that's the basic thing. But what happened with the small-scale fishers or the communities along the coast, particularly in the Western Cape, because the Western Cape's got 12 designated fishing harbours. There are no other designated fishing harbours, although there are other harbours that fishers use, but specifically to the Western Cape. When the allocations were made, and these allocations were made about 10 days before I became the minister, as were the emissions for Eskom, also decided 10 days before I became the minister. So we can speculate, but the point
is
that...
It's very suspicious.
Well, you see, what actually happened was that a decision was done right at the end of the term, and then, of course, before the noise could come, et cetera, and all blew on to me because here I am the new minister. Mm. But these rights were issued for like 15 years. So what happened was a lot of licenses were actually allocated to people living in Gauteng who do not have boats. What? Now, I mean, you know, there is no ocean, there is no capacity. So why were the licenses issued that way? And that's been a thing. Now, of course, I can't speculate as to what happened then. But what I do know is that there was a lot of concern now on, well, who got the licenses.
Yeah.
So the process of the appeals have obviously came to me as the minister. So what I've been doing is I've been adjudicating a number of appeals. In fact, this afternoon there's another one that I'm getting a presentation on because it is very complicated. So what I do when I get those appeals, I have a look and see, well, okay, well, what was done? What is the appeal about? And then what I do try to do, and I said from the beginning, I had that sort of gut feeling, if you want to put it that way. I do try to sway on the side of the small-scale fishers because what we want to do is connect and reconnect our ocean communities back to the ocean.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that was the thing. So I've been attempting to do that, and I've been successful at some. But I do think there was a major problem in the allocation of the licenses, and there was a major problem with how the process was actually done in terms of the policy. Mm. So what I've decided to do is I can't unscramble that because one of the things I did think on, because it was quite a big issue, I thought, okay, what would happen if I just scrap the whole thing and now start again? The problem would be, and the advice I got, is that everybody who got a license would sue. Mm-hmm. But the bigger problem was nobody could fish because now you've got to wait until this process
is finished. Yeah.
You see, and it took forever and so on. So that was not a way. So now I'm getting quite a lot of the pushback, the noise, and the frustration and anger is now being really, it's been landing on me, which is fine. I mean, I will do my job. But the point is that that's the history of it. So what I'm going to do, we'll obviously see how long, you know, I'm the minister, for example, but I intend to take the policy because the next iteration is going to come. So even if it comes in five, well, not five, it'll be 10 or 15, 10 for some and 15 for other, that we can actually write a policy that is better so that when the allocation comes, then we can just pour the decision through that proper policy. But there was a specific decision made on, I think, expanding the rights, giving to more people, but the question is who got them and so on. A lot of the Western Cape fishers were saying, you know what, I was not able to apply, I couldn't get my application in and all of these, and so I'm unhappy. There is also a court case that I'm looking at the moment where, it's a previous one where it talks about indigenous fishing rights that, you know, that needs to also be factored in. So it is extremely prickly. And so what I do say about the director general or the deputy director general of the fisheries branch, she's got one of the hardest jobs in the world because you've got a limited amount of resource that is allocated by government. So you have to make a decision. And then, of course, everybody would want more. And, of course, it's in nobody's interest to overfish. So it is difficult. But what I am doing, I am working on fixing up the harbours because the harbours are in a shocking condition. But I've made some progress initially. So we're moving on that direction. So get the harbours into a better condition so that there's so it's easier for people to do economic activity. And if it, and if it's not fishing, then maybe something else. But also, in my appeal decisions, I have managed to give more fish to the small-scale fishers. Now, the a further problem with the small-scale fisheries is that there were various cooperatives that were set up. Now, of course, what happened was it was a group of people, many of them not necessarily technically expert at managing a cooperative, and many of them are dysfunctional. So there's a cooperative, it gets got an allocation, and then there's people in it. They then proceeded to fight with each other. And many of them, they got stuck, and then they were unable to fish, etc. So I'm unscrambling that by making sure that each of the co-ops has a mentor, that then if there are any management issues, we can assist with them. And I think it's going to take a long time to sort this out because it's very emotive. And also another thing that people also have not necessarily factored in is that the climate is changing. And that's a
You've got to get people to believe that first. I mean, that's, well, that's your first hurdle.
Very strangely in our world, we still have people that are called the climate denialists. Yeah. Now, it's very clear the climate is changing. I mean, the science is there. I mean, I'm not a scientist, but it's so that that's what's happening. It is happening. It is real. We saw in KZN. We saw in the Eastern Cape recently, etc. I've got some reports as well. And, of course, the UN has been giving me some good information. Yeah.
But also, George, I mean, Dion, as we were speaking now, some silly thought came into my mind. We said, you don't know how long you're going to be minister for. You've already broken Des Van Rooyen's record.
I have indeed.
So what happened? You can only say I've broken your record. But also, why was it? Why is it important, as you are saying now, that you want to give that small-scale fishermen some sort of allocation and give them access to that? As Ren was saying, that is about livelihoods. And it seems like you are navigating towards that, as you are saying that it's an emotional issue as well. But also, I think from the DA side and from the work that you've been doing, you've also been emphasizing that we must protect livelihoods, but we must also create jobs. But also, you know, someone must fight for the someone that might not necessarily have the resources, might not necessarily have the influence, the connections. I think that's where you come in. But why is it important that you are doing that?
Well, I mean, it's very important because if you look back historically, I mean, firstly, if you look at it from the historical perspective, is that people have lived along the ocean for generations and they have fished in the ocean. And so it seems only fair that people who've been doing that before and their families have been doing that before can continue to do that. Yeah. So I think that just from a basic fairness perspective, you know, which is a very important, I think. And then also, if you look at the economies, our economy is weak. Our economy is weak because the government has made some really bad decisions on the economy. We are actually a rich country if we properly harness what
the
we
resources,
have,
yeah.
especially our people. So this is the thing. So what the whole idea is that we need economic growth. That is something, if we don't get that in our country, we are just going to carry on having more and more problems, and it's not going to get better. So what the key thing is that we need to – government's role basically is to – accelerate economic activity. It cannot create the jobs. It cannot pick the winners. But what it can do, it can create the environment and it can create the infrastructure for an economy to be built on. So I see it in the fisheries is that if we fix up the harbors And if we have an environment that where people can come, they can do other things at the harbors, for example, there's tourism, there's crafts, there's all sorts of things. That's not only fishing. It's around fishing. It's connected. Mm-hmm. It's also the historical, et cetera. So there's a lot that can be done. And that's the role of government. Make sure that we regulate properly, et cetera, and then let people get on with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that really is something that we haven't got that right yet. But I think coming from the DEA's principle, you know what we are wanting to do is we want a government that is lean, that works for the people and gets stuff done. That's what people have been missing. And I think that's what they're appreciating.
You work a lot, moving the conversation back to climate now. You've been very, very instrumental on COP.
Yes.
And representing South Africa to get good deals on or good sort of arrangements and agreements, I suppose, on COP when it comes to emissions levels and South Africa meeting climate targets, and the just energy transition resides within your department as well, which is a massive, massive sort of key part of, really advancing South Africa's economy and pushing it forward. So can you just take us through a little bit of that process? I know it's very sort of complicated because people think green energy and solar and wind, and there's a lot to kind of feed into it. But
yes,
just talk to us about the first COP meeting that you had, for example, and where South Africa is and how you've leveraged a good deal for us there.
Well, I think if we roll back slightly, I mean, there was the Climate Change Act that actually was it wasn't finished. Well, it was finished at the end of the term, but when I became the minister, it was only then that it actually came into law. And one of the DA's big problems with this Climate Change Act was that it was too much power for the minister. And of course,
you became the minister.
Here I am.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
I think that I'm very sensible, but what it requires on the Climate Change Act is to do a number of things. For example, set sector emission targets, set carbon budgets, etc. I have just signed off regulations for the carbon markets now that we're going to start going on, etc. So we've made a lot of progress on that. But on COP, as I was said before, and it was in the paper, is that before I became the minister, I knew there was a thing called COP. I didn't really know what they did there. But anyway, I did find out. So I did chair mitigation, the mitigation stream with the minister from Norway. We co-chaired that. Now, of course, there's a number of pieces that are very important and hang together.
What is mitigation? Can you just...
Yeah, so mitigation basically is to say, look, we've got this, the complexity of climate change. How are we going to reduce emissions?
Okay.
So that's mitigate. You mitigate the problem, so you stop the problem from getting worse,
okay,
by bringing down your emissions. Then you've got adaptation, because it's the world is changing. You need to get... Now, you need to adapt, because the world is changing. So you need a climate... adaptive infrastructure.
So for us, like moving from coal to renewables, for example, would that be adaptation?
That would be
mitigation.
That would be mitigation.
Okay.
So mitigation would be bring down your carbon emissions. Adaptation is like don't build your house so close to the ocean. Make sure that if it floods, you can keep the water out, etc. So that's the adaptation. But of course, this all costs a lot of money. And then, of course, there's the finance. So the COP, the COP 29. Was the big, this was supposed to be the big finance COP. And yes, indeed, we did make progress on it. But now, of course, the world is changing. The United States withdrew from the Paris Agreement. Mm. We see countries in Europe that are actually moving to the right. So their appetite for supporting other developing economy countries is diminishing. So that was what the just energy transition was all about, is that we needed money to actually transition to a lower carbon economy. Now, the fact of the matter is that it's not about, oh, well, you've got to lose jobs then. No, you can actually get jobs in the green economy. Mm. You can do that. You can build new renewable plants, for example.
New supply chains. Yeah, and
all of that. It is, in fact, possible, but it's hard. So the market must find it attractive enough, and then they will come. That's how it works. So I did co-chair mitigation, and we did come up with a number of initiatives, of course. And the key thing was that we would carry on working towards managing the world's emissions. Because remember, there's the global stocktake that's taking place now, and it's going to be a big issue now in Belém, in Brazil, for COP30 in November. There's pre-COP in October time. So what happens is now everybody has to submit their NDCs, which is the nationally determined contributions. And that then the idea is that they all get added up, say, well, okay, this is what you say you're going to emit. What does that then mean for the world? Because we want to bring down the temperature.
The emissions, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So what I've done recently, in fact, it went through the cabinet last week, is South Africa's proposed NDCs. So that range now will go into the public domain. It actually hasn't been put into the system yet. I've signed it off, cabinet signed it off, but it hasn't yet been issued into the public domain. So we are proposing a range of between 320 to 380 megatons of carbon dioxide equivalents. Now, that might sound like gobbledygook, but basically what that is it measures what you are emitting in your economy.
Okay.
And so that is, in fact, less than we had before, because obviously we want to get more ambitious, yeah. But now there's going to be public participation.
But all of this is quite interesting, Dion, you know, also, but you've mentioned something that is quite interesting and which brings in the contrast between a DA government and or DA ministers and ANC ministers, or what we've been accustomed to over the years. I think we are doing exactly what Soli did with the bill, with the SABC bill, where you were saying that there was too much power assigned to the minister. And he said that he wanted that to be changed so that we limit the power there. And then we are doing exactly the same thing now to say, this law assigns too much power to you as the minister. So it seems like DA ministers are not obsessed about the power control just for the sake of it, but it must be meaningful and it must impact people positively. And I think it's something that is refreshing that we're seeing in government. But with that said, I see you are sporting a very nice a penguin there.
A little tuxedoed bird, yes.
Yeah. Maybe you want to tell us more about that?
Well, I must say, this actual pin belongs to Andrew de Blok, who is yes, he's the Shadow Minister for Forestry, Fishery, and Environment, because this morning when I was coming on the podcast, my office said, well, you know, you should put your penguin pin on because I have a penguin pin. But what happened was I had to go to Nice and sign the BBNJ, which is it's the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdictions.
Yes, you weren't kidding when you said this is international here. Like you travel a lot.
Yes, indeed, because one has to, you know. And the thing is, that's the High Seas Treaty. So I went to Nice, signed it on behalf of South Africa. And when I was there, I wore my penguin pin.
Yeah.
And so somebody came up to me and said, I won't try and make the accent, but said, I love your pin. Because they know I'm from South Africa and everything and about the penguins. And so they looked at it longingly. So I gave them.
Oh, okay.
And so then I didn't have one. But I will give this back to Andrew afterwards. But I'm going to maybe give a gift to all the people that come to the G20, the ministers that come in October. I'll give them a pin.
You got fleeced by a Frenchie, basically.
I was spreading the South African love. But so on the penguins, when I became the minister, there was this, again, another issue lying there that had been lying around for a bit. Because, you know, decisions are hard to take. And what had happened was the previous minister had indicated various boundaries for no fishing. It's basically to make sure that the penguins would get food, because there's now the supposed contest between fishing and fish available for the penguins. So there had been lines drawn, but of course the conservation industry were unhappy about that because they said it weren't scientifically drawn, etc. And there was a court case that was on the way, And I thought, you know, to be honest, I say, you know, and half jokingly, everybody sues me no matter what I do. Yeah. You say, yes, you get sued. You say, no, you get sued. It's fine. My shoulders are broad. So anyway, I then said, look, here is this court case. I mean, obviously now look at the detail. And it was, you know, it was interesting. So the bottom line was that the conservationists and the fishers were going to court and the department because now there has this fight about they can't agree on where these lines need to be drawn. So I said, look, you know, what's going to happen is we're going to fight in court and it's going to get either referred back or it's going to get appealed and the penguins are going to die. That's what's going to happen. So we're going to fight for another 10 years and the penguins
will go. Nothing will actually happen to protecting them. Yeah.
No. So I said, no, let's not do this. I'm a new minister, so take advantage of that, being new. So I said to the various people, the conservationists and the fishers, and I said, look, I want to meet with everybody without the lawyers. Because I think it's a good idea because, I mean, I'm not a lawyer myself, but I value lawyers highly, but, you know, they have a job to do. Mm. And so, you know, anyway, the fishers agreed to have the meeting without the lawyers, but the conservationists would not. So I said, okay, fine, let's meet with the lawyers. And we did. So we got together, we had a meeting, and I said, look, the thing's going to court. Where does this leave the penguins? Because I can't see them in the story you know? Is this all about money? What's going on? So anyway, I then said, right, we're going to put together a group and we are going to have a discussion. You are going to go away, you're going to have a discussion, and then you're going to advise me about where these lines should be drawn. And they said, no, Minister, it isn't possible because for 15 years we've been fighting about where these lines should go. Mm. And I said, well, guess what's going to happen? You're going to try again. That's what you're going to do. And I said, off you go. And then there was this issue. I said, no problem. It still can go to court. So plan A is you find each other. Plan B, we go to court. Yeah. I don't have a problem. About 3 days before the court case was due, somebody came to my office and said, Minister, they found a technical...
That is amazing.
Yes, they agreed. They made a technical agreement. So I said, well, gee, I mean, bowl me over. I mean, I was quite surprised.
So now, having saved the penguins.
Well, there's more.
Oh.
There's more.
Pray tell.
Did we save the penguins? I mean, well, because people are emotional when it comes to the environment. They don't care about emissions. They want to save the penguins.
That's right. So what happened with it there was that I said, fine, I will immediately write it into law. Anyway, so that's exactly what happened. We agreed. We go to court. We have the court put it as an order. And then, and that same week, we changed the boundaries. But I'm also working on what used to be called the bunkering regulations. Now, bunkering is where there's a transfer of oil at sea. And there's
I was thinking like a bunker where the penguin goes to those little cocoons.
well, we've got that. But no, this is where there's the transfer of oil at sea. And so there was an attempt previously by the previous minister to get regulations done, and she was not able to actually get them over the line. So anyway, I picked it up and there we went. And so we are now, I'm going to sign them on the 22nd of August if all goes to plan. That will be regulations that regulate the transfer of not only oil, but basically ship-to-ship transfers at sea. And that will give our penguins less susceptibility to being oiled or oil spills and also manage the noise. Mm-hmm. So we've not only... The DA government's not only given the penguins more food with everybody's agreement, we've also now assisting in the environment with the oiling and the noise. So there's not more that we can do. I'm also told by the conservation group that they've seen an improvement. And the fishers are, and they are honourable people, they are sticking to the rules that we agreed. So that's been quite a success on the penguins. And that's the benefit of being new to the thing, because I did not know that it was impossible to do this. Because everybody said to me, you know, you're mad.
Yeah. The limits don't exist if you don't know about it. So given what you've done for the penguins, I'm going to give you a chance to redeem the reputation of the pangolin.
Ah.
Now,
yes.
What I think I know about the pangolin is that it was at a wet market and caused COVID. That's all I know. Would you like to be an advocate for the pangolin?
Well, actually, I am already, and I'll tell you why. For the G20, I had Billy Bin, who was like a little green man on my letterheads. And I said, for the G20, somebody in my office actually designed a pangolin with a G20 t-shirt on. And the reason why we picked the pangolin was the pangolin is the most trafficked animal by miles. More trafficked than rhino and anything else.
In the world.
Do you know why? I mean, most of us don't even know what a pangolin looks like. If I'm honest, I don't know what it is.
Well, a pangolin is a little creature, a little brown creature with scales. And it's actually like an anteater. So it's got a long tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will go get ants in the ant.
It sounds like a Pokemon, I just have to say.
So with this pangolin, what they do, and it is quite gory, is to traffic it. When the pangolin gets frightened, it will roll up into a little ball.
Oh, okay.
So what
definitely
they do
a Pokemon.
Is they take wire and then they wrap it around the pangolin and then they traffic it that way.
Oh.
So it's a massive problem. And to be honest, I didn't even know there was a pangolin trafficking problem. And again, I didn't know what a pangolin was. But the thing is, I do now. And so what we've done is we've elevated its profile by putting it onto my letterhead. We've also got a thing called the Pangolin Pact. And that is a discussion I'm having in the G20. Because obviously we're the president this year, and I am the chair of the Climate and Sustainability Working Group. So we're working on an international agreement, a memorandum of understanding where we will work together, because we already do, but it's basically about action. Specifically countries that are recipient countries like Vietnam and China, but China in particular. So that's the Pangolin Pact, is where we want to have this agreement that we will work harder and better at stopping this scourge. But what happens to our wildlife is it's not acceptable. And
yeah.
We've battled with that for a very long time because we know law and order in the country is also weak, etc. But now, as I mentioned earlier about the medium-term development plan, is that when we discussed it in cabinet, I raised that issue together with Antarctica and the exclusive economic zone. I said the countering illicit wildlife trafficking, that should be with the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment. It is now the lead department. So my people, because of course we've got the rangers, we've got the green scorpions, we've got the fisheries control officers, they are all working in the field. So I'm coordinating it better. So my department is able to go to the various departments like the police and the Border Management Agency and the Navy and the Army and say, we are the lead here. Now they can lead the charge. Because remember, there's so many other problems in the country. Pangolin trafficking maybe won't feature.
Yeah, not the priority.
So we've done a lot of good work on that. So so the pangolin, it is a symbolic creature of the fight that we've got in our hands. Because everybody knows about the rhino.
Yeah.
But ask them about the pangolin.
And no one knows
And
about
nobody
the
knows. But it's not only that. We've got, people stealing the ants and the frogs.
I beg your pardon?
Yes, people are stealing the ants. You won't believe me, but it's so. Because what's happened, happened is that our wildlife and those amazing things have got currency.
Mm.
People want to have, I don't know, they clearly want to have an ant farm on their desk. I don't know.
From South Africa.
From South Africa. So we have these issues. But what we can say, and I'm very excited about that, is that we've got it right on the front line of the agenda. That's the one thing. And the other thing is that we are talking honestly to all the nations. Because remember, we're a non-aligned country, and so we must behave that way.
Allegedly, I mean.
And But one of the good benefits of that is that everybody does, in fact, want to speak to South Africa.
That's good.
So wherever I've been, I've never been able to keep up with all the bilaterals because everybody wants to talk to us. And they're very excited about this weird government we've got called the GNU, which is like a coalition, but it isn't. And what is
it's like
this?
A fancy coalition.
Yeah. And it's an interesting animal, just like the GNU.
So you mentioned Antarctica. And I think at some point before we let you go, we should get your take on some of the most interesting places you've been. But I want to take advantage of you. So there's a court case in KZN today.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to let everybody at home know, I have a friend whose child is on a boating team. And one of the things they've been reaching out to me about is how the kids are getting sick from the water because of the sewage pollution and all that sort of stuff. Now, the DA had actually taken action on that. But of course, another party jumped in, and I think you are sued in your official capacity as minister as well. Do you want to unpack that issue for us? What is actually going wrong there? And is there anything you can do, or is this just on the Etegwini government?
Etegwini government, yes. Again, with everything in government, it is complicated. But let's roll backwards. My department, oddly, is not responsible for upstream. So, for example, when the pollution gets to the ocean, it's my problem. But upstream is not. That's the Department of Water and Sanitation.
Uh-huh.
Them and the municipality is responsible for the sewerage, right? Mm. So, yes, this other party has been saying, well, you know, the minister's been doing nothing, etc. That is absolutely not so. What supposed to happen is that the city of Etegwini is responsible for its sewage works. They are responsible in the first instance, right? Now, of course, they have completely not managed it. It's a big mess. It is filthy, etc. It's not acceptable. And it's not only there. It's in other places in the country as well. I have said there was a time when water and environment was in the same department, but water is not with the environment department. I think it should be because it would make life a lot easier. Mm. But nonetheless, so the way the system works is that the municipality in the first instance is supposed to look after that. They did not do that. And they were not held to account, clearly. And then the water and sanitation is responsible then for the river, etc. And then my department is responsible for when it gets to the ocean. So what has happened is, and I do have all the information because, of course, we had to go to court and collect it, etc. What we do is we have inspectors. They're called EMI, Environment Management Inspectors, commonly known as the Green Scorpions.
Ah, okay.
Right? They report through to me ultimately. And what they do is they would then go and say, look, there's a violation. There's a problem here. The ocean, it's the ocean that we're looking at because that's our mandate. Water's coming downstream and it is filthy and it's causing marine pollution and it's an issue. They would then issue directives, which they've done. They did that to the city of Cape Town as well. Mm. So what happened in the city of Cape Town is interesting is that the municipal manager is now being held personally responsible. That's what's happening in Cape Town for a particular issue at Mitchell's Plain. But in Etegwini and in other places, because the pollution is the same, that they keep moving the municipal managers. So the question is, when you issue a directive...
Who's responsible?
The council does nothing. So the council just says, oh, well, we don't care. They go to court, spend the people's money defending themselves, and then there's nobody to hold to account because the municipal manager's gone and everything. So that's the complication. That's why it was actually easier in Cape Town because there's stability and continuity. But that's the problem. So I welcome this court case because it's going to be quite clear to say, well, look, Etegwini, do this. Mm. And I've said, I want to hold that council personally responsible. Because there's no other way. There's no other way. So we have a massive pollution problem in our country, and it is a system problem, and it needs to be fixed because 91% of our country is water constrained already. And it is not looked after properly. It's dirty, and it's getting polluted, etc. You've got all sorts of problems like acid mine drainage, etc. But again, it's not the direct mandate of my department. Yeah. I'm very happy to take it because I have an idea of how you actually fix this. And where you have to fix it is you've got to go back to the municipality. That's the source.
Yeah,
but the municipalities have got no engineers. They've got no capacity. They've got no money. How do you break that cycle? Yeah.
It's another example from many ministers who've told us that a lot of the root cause of the problems that end up on their desk, you know, come down to failed local government and municipal government. But on a lighter note, Dion, I mean, you said that you spend much of your time outdoors, you know, being the Minister of the Environment. What's the funnest sort of excursion that you've gone on? What's the most exciting trip that you've taken?
I must say that... I went on a ranger course when I, in January actually this year, of course it was the hottest week of the year, but I thought, well, look, you know, given that I'm not really outdoorsy, I need to know what the rangers do because, of course, ultimately they all report then to me at the end of the day. So I was in the Kruger National Park for 2 weeks at the Wildlife College, and amazing. I said, spare no, don't pull any punches. I must do this course now. It's a 2-week thing. And so it was amazing to see what they were doing in the field. You know, we were actually there on the front line. I saw lots of animals, saw elephants, etc. Never try and outrun an elephant, eh?
Yeah.
Never do that.
What are you supposed to do?
No, what
Stop,
you do.
Drop and roll?
No, what you do is if you lift your hand up, and you wave it, then the elephant will back off. Depends on the circumstances, but that I actually saw that happening because, you know, somebody that was with us, you know, the elephant was really close and then he turned, he wanted to run. So the ranger grabbed him and said, "Don't run. You can't outrun an elephant." He said, "Just stay here, put up your hand and then move forward and wave." Of course, the poor guy was terrified, but he did it. But he did it. We now call him the Elephant Whisperer.
Like, this is an article of faith. You want me to put up my hand and trust that this massive beast is just going to halt?
Stop. You see? So that was also quite fascinating to learn. Also, I witnessed a rhino dehorning recently now at the G20. We also showed all the countries that were there, their technical delegates were there. It was the ministerials October. And so they then dehorned two rhinos. And that was also quite emotional because, you know, of course, they have to dart the animal. It falls down and it shakes as well. Mm. And it's very intrusive, but it's saving its life. Mm. So I think what has happened to me, it was interesting. Barbara Creasy actually said that to me when we met. She said, "You know what?" She said, "This portfolio will change you." Because we were talking about economics and all sorts. And I thought, okay, well, let's see. But it has, because I'm very mindful now of the fragility and the vulnerability of these incredible creatures that we have around us. They are completely defenseless. I mean, yes, they can try and fight back with their natural, you know, like a lion can try and bite you and elephant can stand on you. But actually, the biggest predators are people and then the poachers, etc. So it's – and these are assets, if you want to see it that way, for the entire world. So South Africa – is looking after these amazing creatures for humankind.
Yeah.
And we're doing it on our own. And that's why I'm saying to everybody, look, you know, we need your help. We can't do this on our own. This is for you as well. You come, we want to look at the rhinos. Well, you know, who's going to protect them? We are. So I'm very mindful that it's not only all the wild animals and the mammals in the ocean, but there's the big five in the ocean as well. I mean, you know, I learned this too. But it's also the environment, the air we're breathing. So the responsibility of this department is massive. Mm. And I think, you know, because I also thought like, okay, well, you know, we negotiated. I wasn't part of that, but we got six portfolios. And this one is massive and very impactful and so important. You know, how did it end up in my lap here?
But also, you know, at least I've learned something today that if an elephant charges at you, you must have.
But in theory, yes.
Yeah, but my immediate instinct was, yay, footer.
They're also amazing creatures. They're not to be interfered with.
But also, Dion, one thing that I am particularly more interested in is the first day when you walked into the office as a minister, like, here is a new political principle. It's from the days, not from the ANC. Like, we know those departments are filled with cadres. What was it? Was it, you know, the anxiety? Was the tension? What happened? Who tried to offer you water or something like
well,
that?
Well, I must say it was very memorable because what happened actually was we were supposed to be sworn in on the Tuesday. So we all went up to Pretoria. And then it was changed that we were going to get sworn in on a Wednesday in Cape Town. So we all had to return. But I'd already set up a meeting with the Director General because, of course, land on your feet, get going straight away, because that's what I like to do. So I went. And of course, by then, you know, they'd made arrangements for me to come anyway. So I arrived there. And when I get out the car, there were a number of people outside, obviously coming to greet me. Now, of course, I don't know anybody. And there I was. So there was a number of people. I shook their hands, everything. And I went inside and then had a meeting with the Director General. I think she was very nervous, actually, because I think that, you know, people hear all things about the DA, like, you know, like we're the devil, you know, I don't know. And so I think there was quite a bit of anxiety in that, like, what is this?
And the change, also for the first time in 30 years, to have a different party come in, I think, must have been difficult.
So I described it when I went home, I described it almost as like, it's like, you know, you see these movies, these science fiction movies, and then the aliens land. And then I thought it was like this, like, okay, the alien has landed and then now I'm going to this place and then everybody's looking and thinking, I wonder who's going to get eaten. it was like that. But I think that there was a lot of anxiety in, well, here's this new government. You know, of course, it's not going to be the same as it was before. And will it be? Will it last? Will it hang together? I mean, you know, there was lots of noise at that time. So, yeah, I think my first impressions were that I was surrounded by people who I think did want to participate in this government and, you know, let's get things happening. Mm. Obviously, I've learned a lot of things over time. I've been in politics for a long time, so I don't ever accept anything at face value, unfortunately. So I like to collect the facts for myself. So in the department, I have done quite a few initiatives in terms of becoming more efficient because there's massive inefficiency. And I discovered a couple of things where, you know, the money was being spent and like there's this so-called thing called community outreach. I'm saying, well, what are you community outreaching about? What is the outcome? What for, et cetera? And I think that has been some sort of political activity happening in that particular space, which is not acceptable at all. Also, I mean, I will share this. I got a request across my desk for a greening program, right? And this was going to be a national thing. It was going to be provinces, it was going to be municipalities, it was going to be, and you know, on the face of it, it's a great idea because what you want to do is you want to green the environment. You know, you want to, you know, maybe plant fruit trees, and also you can mitigate carbon that way, etc. So, but the price of this was 150 million rand.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. So I said, well, I'm not going to sign this. What on earth is this? You know what? Well, and then. So no, I did not support that, did not sign it off. We are planting a lot of trees, but certainly we're not doing that. I want donations, I want efficiency. So that was one instance.
Is that what was meant by greening, was just planting stuff for 150 million rand?
Yes.
It's like that flag issue.
And
the flagpole.
And then there was another one that came through to me as well, was where there was this, again, I've now centralized it in my office and I've said, well, any outreach, it must come through my office and we will look at who's going where, what's the cost, what for, etc. Mm. Because now, of course, I'm very alert.
A lot more oversight over the department. And have you, I mean, in terms of corruption, that's like the big thing for South Africans. Was there corruption in the department? Have we fired anybody sort of in your ministry? I know it's huge. Maybe you're still in the process, but, you know, South Africans want accountability.
What I did was when I became the minister, also I'm the appeal authority on the labor matters, and I got a pile of labor matters. And I, of course, read everything because, you know, of course, I will do that. And a number of them had been dragging on for years. People had been suspended for years. And now they were saying, well, no, we need to take it to a court or a something because of this, whatever. And I fired everyone. I actually fired every single one of them in that pile. And I got no comeback. Nothing. Nobody fought. Nobody sued. No one did anything. They've been lying around forever. So that's the decisive management you need. I've also seen got an example of where there was this outreach, another one of outreach, VIP lunch, 400,000 rand.
Yes.
And I said, well, they can bring their own sandwiches.
Wait, what does that mean when you have VIPs visiting your office?
No. So you have an outreach. So there's an outreach and there's people that are invited and there's these very important guests, all of them political. And then you have this VIP lunch and it's 400,000.
Oh, wow. How many people are you feeding? What does this mean?
Well, it worked out to about 2,900 per head. I said, well, what are people going to be eating? No.
Like lobster. I mean, did they get a quota for that?
So I think that it is because the machine of government has not worked well. We know that there are enormous problems and also they work in silos, etc. And we're working to try to improve that. It's going to take time. But just from the things that I've been able to see with my own eyes and reach, because, of course, the minister has an enormous amount of power, like I said, an enormous amount of influence. Also what I did was I've changed delegations now. I think this was an important thing because I then said, no, who approves all these things? And well, no, this one and this one. I said, no, I'm looking at all the delegations because I got a request to carry on with the previous ones. And I said, no, I'm looking at all the delegations. And then I took away some delegations. And then the response of some was, but you can't. I said, yes, I can. All of the influence comes from the minister. So I can change all of the delegations if I want to because I'm held to account. So I did that. And I did not have major pushback. I think it was more not sharing the information with me rather than manipulating it and hiding it. But I think the discipline is there now. And we also had an interaction with the portfolio committee today where we're getting more efficient. So we are managing now to cut back, get rid of all of that waste. And what is this outreach about? Yes, if you're going to go and do something that's meaningful to the community, then by all means. But when you're entertaining politicians and what for?
At 2,000 rand.
Just completely
ahead.
Ridiculous.
2,900.
Yeah, goodness me. The other thing that I once saw, maybe just to divert a bit from this important conversation, I saw, you know, like you're watching the news, there's a big conference happening of a political party mentioned by name. And you see the president coming, and before the president sits down, the protectors come, they change the water on the team, they bring the on. Is it that hectic even with you guys?
Well, actually, it is quite, well, a bit troubling, to be honest, because, of course, we are new and we are relatively naive, maybe, in some instances. But I went to Isimangaliso, our amazing wetland reserve. It was one of my first visits I went to. There's a few things that needed to be discussed. And so we were having lunch. And then my PA at the time came up to me and said, it's just going to be a bit delayed because they are testing the food. So I said, what do you mean, testing the food? And it's for that. It's for possible poisoning. Now, of course, I don't know with the depth of the issues, et cetera, but I had to take my protectors with me. And my protector said, look, they said that the executive or some of the executive are actually protected by people with automatic weapons, or semi-automatic weapons. So it tells you something about the environment that people are working in. Now, KZN, we know, is quite a complicated place.
Yeah.
So, but I certainly am not a paranoid person. So, but what I have learned is that, you know, when you're dealing with things and it's often just about the money, all about the money. When you know I'm focusing on fighting abalone poaching and the rhino horn issue and the lion issue, etc., I am much more mindful now of the fact that we aren't working in an environment that is completely benign.
Yes.
So I am mindful actually of that. So what I do is, I mean, you know, I go all over the place, but I really try to focus on getting the stuff done. It's on my desk. I've got piles of stuff. I've got decisions to make, etc. I'm not swanning around everywhere. But, of course, I do go. If I have to go to places, then I will, of course, go there because I want to see for myself. But I do carry my own water.
Just to be safe.
Yeah.
But also has an interesting fact. Ryan. Well, maybe your protectors might not be very happy with me now. But I saw you one of these past weeks in Parliament, you driving yourself, leaving Palm like even. What's this one doing now?
Are you allowed to drive yourself?
Well, actually, we won't go into too much detail, but when I got sworn in on the day it was, I think it was a Wednesday, they immediately then said, go to this holding room, and then they assigned protectors to us. And then they gave us a whole thesis on this is what's now you, obviously you're now executive of the government, you property of the state, all of this, and our job is to protect you. And you got to understand that. So we all get protectors. My own view is that, like, you know, I didn't move when I won't say where I live, but I did not move when I became a minister because I obviously live in Cape Town. And so there was a conversation about, well, you know, you need to move into state accommodation and all of this. And I said, well, actually, no, I don't want to. I like where I live and it is important. And also, you know, for Craig, because, you know, life must go on. I'm not moving. So I haven't and I didn't and I'm still at home. And I do not have protectors in my driveway because I don't think that that is useful. And I think we've got our police services must focus on other things. Mm. But I am aware that, you know, it is so that we need to have security. But, you know, it depends on how you've got to manage your own security, really, in a way. So I remember I was at I went to lunch recently, and so somebody was there and they said, "Ah, we saw you walking the other day and you didn't have your protectors with you." And I said, "Oh no, you probably just didn't see them." And the reason why I said that was I don't want people to know that I don't have any at the time. But I said, "No, you just didn't see them because they're like, you know, they're there." But the fact is, well, no, I want to have as normal a life. So I don't. I think it's important. I do think the executive needs to have protection. There is no doubt about it, because you never know the stuff we get and the things people say to us, etc. You got to just be mindful of that. You know, you got to be sensible. But what I do is that I don't have my protectors around me all the time, and I do get about, and you know, it's
live
about
your life, yeah.
If people know, if I'm going to go somewhere and people know I'm coming there, then absolutely you got to make sure you have protectors, because I've been to places where people got quite rough, actually. Mm. So you know that. But if people don't know where I'm going, I don't think I have a particularly high profile, but you know, nobody's ever bothered me. So that's the kind of semblance of normality of life that you want to have.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I think it is important that there is that support. But I do, like on the weekend, for example, I do like to get in the car with Craig and go somewhere.
Take a little road trip.
Yeah, because yeah. It's the normality. I mean,
some alone time.
Yeah. Mm, exactly.
And I just want to touch on something you mentioned earlier on in the conversation, that becoming a minister has changed you. Mm-hmm. And I just want to pinpoint that maybe slightly more emotive part of being not only a minister but a politician. Mm. But what makes you get up every day, you know, to go to the office? What motivates you? What's that driving force? Why do you do what you do? I think that's really something that we would like to know.
Well, I think, as I mentioned, I think at heart I am an activist. I mean, I am very curious about the world. Ever since I was very small, I'd be like curious, like, how does this thing work? You know, this little car or something. I also look for patterns in things. So that's the one thing. The other thing is, I don't have a particularly high need for affiliation. You know, I'm very independent. You know, I don't need to be affirmed all the time and praised, and I don't need that. I also don't have a very high need for power either, although I do have a lot of influence, I believe, both in the party and out there in my job. But I have a high need for achievement in terms of getting things done. Mm. You know what I mean? The world is, I mean, also, you know, we're born and we live and then we die. And in between, stuff happens, you know. You can't always control what happens to you, but you can manage your response to it. So what I've chosen to do in my life is that I'm going to, obviously, it's an amazing adventure. I mean, I'm 59 now. I mean, you know, I'm getting older, etc. Still relatively young, but, you know, I'm certainly not a teenager anymore. So I think, like, as I'm getting older, I'm realizing that there is, in fact, you know, this period that you're in, and you can choose. Now, some people have fewer choices than others, but, you know, we all have choices of some kind. And I think, well, I choose to do things that for me are meaningful, and actually my job happens to coalesce with that. So here I am, the Minister for Forestry, Fishery, Environment. We've got enormous complexities, but I like complexities. It intrigues me. I don't know the answers to all the questions. I'm intrigued by it. I'm fascinated by it. So what I find is, well, obviously I get very tired, and then I go to sleep, and luckily I go straight to sleep, and then I'm sleeping. But then I wake up in the morning, and I'm ready to go. Hmm. Why? It's because I'm energized, because I think, I wonder what's going to happen today, because I don't know what's going to happen today. It's really don't know. But what I do know is that I have got the power and the influence to get things done. And so the way I look at it like this is, I work every day like it might be my last day in government, because you never know.
Yeah.
But I plan like I'll be there forever. That's what I'm doing. So That's what energizes me. And also then when I see the little successes and I think, oh, well, you know, I don't need to be praised for it. But I look and I think, oh, you know what? I had my hand in that. So when we went to see the penguins and I thought, I looked at them and I thought, I'm so pleased I could give you a little bit more food. It just fills me with joy. And I think that if we can do good things, everybody does good things, well, you know, the world will be a much better place.
Yeah,
absolutely. And if we can, we must.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know?
So, Dion, it's been such an honor to chat with you. I think for us as younger colleagues, not that much younger, unfortunately, your drive, your curiosity and your energy is also inspiring. It's so wonderful to learn from. Thank you for your
thank you for inviting
today.
Me. It was very exciting. Must
wonderful.
Say.
Yeah,
thanks for chatting.
And I hope everyone who's watching will like, share and subscribe. And we will catch you in the next episode.